The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thanks for coming. We're going to do a kind of Q&A for about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to audience questions and back and forth. I've read Tariq over the years and this new book, What I Believe, and I guess I want to break up the time into talking a bit about this book, talking about where you are now in your life and scholarship and so on, and then about the controversies that have come up about you as a public figure. As I was saying to Tariq backstage, he has answered these questions many times, so I have already apologized for asking him questions that he's had to answer many times. But let's just start with what you're actually arguing in this book. For instance, you say that you belong to a reformist trend in Islam. You acknowledge you do not represent all Muslims and all points of view. Can you just give an explanation? What do you mean by a reformist trend in Islam? What are you for? What are you against?
Yes, thank you, and thank you for this invitation here. I think it's a good way to start, because very often when we speak about Islam, it's as if we are essentializing Islam and not understanding from where the people are talking. And as I'm saying, and I did this in other books, which is also to make it clear that we have different trends in Islam, that we don't only have two, you know, the good Muslims and the bad Muslims, and this is the way sometimes under colonization the Muslims were described and categorized. So there are many trends, and to start with, we have at least 6-7 trends that are so important. So you have the traditionalists, when some Muslim scholars are following a very specific school of thought, a madhab, and they are following a school, they are within a tradition. You have literalists, where now we call them very often Wahhabi, but they are this is not the way they are talking about themselves. They are talking about being Salafi, and Salafi is to come back to the origin, and sometimes in a very literalist way. We have Sufi, lots of Sufi, the mystical dimension. We have rationalists, that the people are very keen to go on a rational reading of the scriptural sources. We have people who are very much focusing on the political issues, and sometimes in a way which could be, as it happened, violent. And there are the reformists. And the reformists, and this is where I put myself, so you can see that it's not representing all the Muslims, even though what I'm saying is that the reformist trend within this, like, the classical Islamic tradition is the mainstream trend, saying two things, and this is why within the reformist trend we also have to differentiate between different ways of being reformist. So what I am advocating is within we have two sets of texts in Islam that are the reference for the Muslims, the Quran as the very word of God and the prophetic traditions. In these texts, there are principles and some verses that are immutable. They are transhistorical. So we should not go for contextualizing them. So this is why, for example, the Muslims, as to their creed, will say there are 6 pillars of faith. They are not going to change, to believe in God, to believe in the prophets, to believe in the books, and all that is not going to change. And the 5 pillars of our faith are not going to change. We pray exactly like the Muslims were praying. Wherever you are in the States or in Saudi Arabia, you will pray the same. We fast the same. These are the pillars that are not going to change. And you have some obligations and some prohibitions. They are not going to change. Like, for example, wherever we are, we don't drink alcohol, we don't eat pork, and so on. Now, there are other principles and other things that are changeable, and it's known in the Islamic tradition as al-mutaghayyirat, depending on the geography and the culture and the time. And this is where the Muslims should make up their mind, understanding the principles, extracting the principles from the text, and understanding that they have to contextualize their way of dealing with the environment. So, for example, when you deal with ethics, you can extract principles, ethical principles, from a specific period of time. So, for example, how it was revealed. And you have to get a sense of a new model to implement the principles in a new period of time. So this is to be a reformist, which is to come back to the spirit of the origin, but with the intelligence of the time in which we are living. So this is where I stand, clear on the principles that are constructing my faith, but very clear on the fact that there will be no faithfulness to the principles without evolution in the understanding. And I'm going quite far on this, and one of the books that I wrote, which is advocating this, is Radical Reform, mm-hmm. that the Muslims should come with something which is even deeper in the way they deal. Just to end with this, because it's a very important discussion that we have among Muslims, is that for 20 years I have been, you know, following, and I have been told by people and scholars that we're talking about reformism. But, and islah, the Arabic word is islah and tajdid, renewal and reforming our understanding. But I ended up understanding that we were using the same terms, but with not the same understanding. That you have people speaking about reform, they want an adaptational reform. We adapt ourselves to the world the way it is. And my view is not this. I think that all the philosophies, all the spiritualities, all the religions, they are not here just to accept the world the way it is, but on an ethical ground to be a transformational presence, is to transform the world for the better. So you have two ways. You are obsessed with the law and you adapt, and you have a vision, an ethical vision, and you transform for the better. I'm from the second movement.
Right, which seems a very fair notion of reform, because even people, for instance, here, who we were talking backstage, who adapt a similar view toward the American Constitution, will find things in the Constitution that they want to interpret in a way that will reform the way the world is at the moment, not just accept the way the world is at the moment. But would you agree that if you make a division between what is changeable in Islam and what is not changeable, that in fact many people within the Islamic world disagree about which is which, and that's part of the tension? I wouldn't think that there's unanimity about which parts, which surahs, which parts of the hadith cannot be changed and which can. And that would seem part of the trench work, in a way, that you have to do in people talking and debating about different practices.
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly what is happening. That within, you know, I'm always repeating that sometimes it's easier for me to talk to you than to talk to other Muslims, you know, fellow Muslims, because it's quite difficult within. Because some of the Muslims, just by the only fact that what I am saying is that they are changeable things, they are saying, oh, it might be that you are not within Islam, and putting you outside the realm of Islam, which is, you have some trends, these are minorities, but still we have to deal with this internal dialogue. And I would say that today, one thing that I am advocating as something which is one of our main challenges, is the intra-community dialogue, and not only the face an inter-religious dialogue, which is how we deal with this. So yes, not only within the reformist trend, we don't agree on the interpretation of some verses, for example, which one is clear-cut and which one is open for interpretations. Mm. You know, the scholars from the very beginning, some were saying there is only 1% that is immutable and clear-cut, where others were saying 3%, and when you deal with a set of texts, it's a huge difference. Right. So I would say, yes, there is and this is good to start with this, for the Muslims to understand that there is an accepted diversity in Islam. And we need to understand that even if, you know, I don't agree with the literalist, as long as he or she is doing it for himself or herself, that is your business. I'm not going to judge you. You are still in Islam. I don't believe or I don't share what you think. For example, we have today Muslims saying that music is prohibited in Islam, movies are prohibited in Islam. They don't come with what are the objective and the ethics of arts. It's wrong. I say, okay, it's for you, it's wrong. But don't tell me that I'm less Muslim than you. You know, this kind of debate is still there. On the other side, which is also important here, is this understanding that this diversity is a reality of our time, and then we have to deal with it. And we have to manage diversity in order not to end up with divisions. but we should avoid dreaming of uniformity. This is wrong. So you don't have one Muslim representing Islam for all. This cannot be the way, and we have to avoid thinking like this. And sometimes we have to say this to governments. So we have governments today in the West say, who is speaking for Muslims? They say, nobody on his own or her own. It's diversity, and you have to deal with this. And I would like our fellow citizens in the States, but also elsewhere, to understand that Islam, in the way we just started this discussion, is as complex as Christianity, as complex as Judaism and Buddhism. You have different trends, different ways. And when you get this sense that it's complex, you get also a sense that it's important to know the people, to be able to just situate them in the landscape.
Let me ask you this. As years went on, I was the book editor of the local newspaper here. Whenever I wrote something about Islam, whenever we published a book review about Islam, we would get a storm of emails, some of them really hostile and angry, some of them illiterate. But it certainly convinced me that most people here who are not Muslims don't know very much about Islam. It seems to me one of the misunderstandings perhaps that often takes place among non-Muslims here is that if they're thinking about Christianity, for instance, they think, well, if you're a Christian, you don't necessarily agree with everything, you know, in Christian documents and sacraments and so on. But there's a tendency to think if you're Muslim, you agree with every single thing that any Muslim anyplace else thinks. And so you agree with every verse in the Quran, you agree with every saying of the Hadith. Do you see that as a problem? Is there this tendency for non-Muslims to think that somehow if you're Muslim, you accept everything?
Yes, I think that this is, in fact, it's not only a problem, it's the common understanding. The majority understanding in the West is that the Muslims, because they believe that the Quran is the very word of God, anything which is going to be done in the name of the Quran is going to be supported by all the Muslims, which is wrong. Wrong because of what we were just saying right now is that we have a text. And, you know, last week I was with Christopher Hitchens, and we had this discussion. He's very much against religions and not only against Islam. But he said something about, because the Muslims believe that this book is the very word of God, the problem is that it's going to be a religion which is dealing with the world as a total concept. And, you know, from total to totalitarianism, it's very quick to get. So he was connecting this with that and saying that the Muslims, by definition, because the book is the book, are going to have the same understanding. And my response to this was, no, the book is not the problem. The problem is the reader. So the problem is how do you read the book? Because you have, yes, Muslims reading the book and not contextualizing it, not understanding that it was an eternal book revealed over 23 years. So you have to connect the book with the environment, that there are things that are beyond history and things that they are within history. So I think that this is very important to understand that first, the Muslims are not going to agree because it's said or interpreted by some Muslims. They say, oh, it's fine, it's a Muslim, so it's right. And for example, yes, we had, for example, people quoting the Quran in a very literal way and saying that we can kill a non-Muslim or kill a civilian in the name of Islam. Say, no, this is not only non-Islamic, it's against the whole message. You take a verse, you transform the understanding because you are focusing on one verse without getting the whole message. So we have this discussion. This is one. The second thing which is important is that very often behind the question that you are putting and the misunderstanding that we have, many of our fellow citizens in the West, and it happened over the last few weeks in this country, with the community center in New York, with the burning of Quran Day in Florida, is this
question. I'm going to ask you about those, so please speak to those if you want those controversies also.
We can talk about them, but just what is happening behind is the loyalty of the Muslims to the country. In fact, the perception is Islam is not really an American religion, and Muslims are not really loyal to the country. So it's a question of loyalty to the country. And the perception is this one. Why? Because their connection is with a concept which is the Ummah, all the Muslims. So they will be for Muslims before being for America. And I think that this understanding is there, and the Muslims should be very clear on that. Though they have to be self-critical. That it's not because we are Muslims and we are a member of a spiritual community that we are going to end up my community right or wrong. That's not this kind of belonging. It's when it's right, I'm with you. But when it's wrong, I have to stand up against what you are saying. So in the name of my religion, sometimes I have to stand up against Muslims because what they are doing is against the very essence of the message. Mm-hmm. So it's not, and this is exactly it in the States. I think that if I'm asked about citizenship, I would say the only rights American citizenship is a critical citizenship. When my government is doing right, I'm with you. But if you are doing wrong, in the name of my citizenship, I should stand up and tell you that's wrong. For example, I think that all, you know, when Dr. Martin Luther King was talking, you know, he had to make a decision, to make a choice where he was dealing about the civil rights and the black rights, the rights of the black in the country, and at the same time the Vietnamese war. And so I'm not to give up on my rights, and I'm not going to give up on my beliefs. Mm-hmm. This is a wrong war. So he decided to say it in the name of his ethics. And I think that this is not to put in question his loyalty to America. Mm-hmm. Because he said something, if we are wrong, so the American Constitution is wrong. He's using the American narrative to judge a government policy. And I've said that the Muslim should put themselves in this mainstream to understand that this is it. And to respond to the question of the loyalty, which is a very deep question. It's a very deep psychological question.
Yeah, no, and that theme, I think, is throughout your work, and I appreciate that theme in your work, standing up for the ideals as against practice sometimes that is done in a mistaken understanding of the ideals of the religion. But I want to come back with another question to your scholarly side, because this is another sort of reaction that I got a lot in emails whenever we ran anything about what the Quran says or what Hadith, you know, says, a distinction that it seemed to me those not terribly literate in Islam often made between the idea that if something is in the Quran, that cannot be questioned because that is the word of God. But all of the scholarly tradition after that, that can be questioned. So that if there is a bad surah under almost any translation, well, you still can't question it because that is the word of God. Is that a distinction that is sensible at all to a scholar of Islam?
Yes, it could be. It could be because, as we said, within the realm of the Islamic scholarship, you have some scholars that have a literalist understanding of some of the verse, and sometimes very, very ahistorical, no contextualization, not even a perception of what could be said about this, for example, in very sensitive issues when it comes to, you know, for example, differentiating between principles and models. It's a very deep question here. You have some scholars, they are coming back to the first period of Islam, what we call the second half of the prophecy in Medina, the Medinian period. And they are coming back and say, you know, in order to be faithful to Islam, we have to duplicate what was done. And they are saying, this is the model. And what the discussion here is not, look, be careful. The verses of the Quran about this period of time, what you have to extract from them are not the historical model, is the trans-historical principles. So you extract the principles, but you are not going to duplicate the model in Medina. Why? Because if you want now to, for example, enforce the Medinian model in Philadelphia, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Because the world is complex. So the model are historical and the principles are universal. But some Muslims, in their reading, they are confusing the two. So they have some. So when you are quoting the Quran, it's not enough to say you quote the Quran. Quoting is already interpreting. So we have some verses that are clear-cut beyond history. But even with this, for example, in the penal code, just after the death of the Prophet of Islam, we had one of his followers coming and saying, for anything which has to do with, you know, the thieves, men and women, in a period of famine, the text is clear-cut. He said, because we are facing a context of famine, you cannot implement that. So he removed the implementation of a clear-cut verse because the historical conditions were not there. This is a very important point, which is you take a rational understanding of the environment and you understand that if you literally implement the verse, you are betraying the end, the objective of the verse. So in the name of a verse, you forget justice. So this is why you always implement rules in the name of the ends. But if you forget the ends, you may end up implementing the rules that are becoming unjust because they are not taking into account the environment. Mm-hmm. So this is a discussion among scholars. And when the non-Muslims are questioning this, I think they are legitimate to question because it's not obvious that we have this discussion among Muslims. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's between, you know, the scholars. So we really sometimes have to make it clear that we have these discussions and these understandings, that there are many trends, that it's not always easy. And then, for example, really, we are struggling. For example, another example, yet we go in Saudi Arabia and say, women in Saudi Arabia cannot drive a car. In the name of that, they are not going to be isolated in one place. Say, what is this interpretation of a very, you know, a prophetic tradition, which is the great majority of the Muslims around the world find it wrong. Mm-hmm. But this is an interpretation. So not all the Muslims agree on one specific interpretation. There are many, and it's not easy to come to an agreement, but still the mainstream Muslim thought and mind and understanding today is coming from the reformist tradition. Mm-hmm. And the proof of that is not just to dream about the future, is to look at what is happening, for example, in all the Western countries. The Western Muslims are able to be faithful to their principles and to take into account the environment. Loyal to the country, the American Constitution, they know the language of the country, and these other three L's that I am always mentioning, to be part of a society, to belong to a society, you need three L's, to abide by the law, to speak the language. And the language, I mean it. I mean language and culture and sense of humor and taste, and all this is part of the language mm-hmm. of a country. There is the verbal language, and there is the non-verbal language, which is so important. And the third is loyalty to the country that we were talking about. I think that because we have this now in front of us, beyond the perceptions that the Muslims are obsessed with the text, look at their life. And through their life, you can understand that they are dealing with this new environment and they are finding their way. And this is the good news that is just shown on the ground.
Let me give you a chance to talk a little bit to the two recent, you know, fiery controversies here, unfortunately, about the mosque in New York and about the threat to burn the Quran in Florida. But let me give it a little bit of a tweak because you know Europe so well, and I'm glad that you're now coming to know America after that whole visa thing got settled. You're aware, of course, of the controversy going on in Germany now about the issue of Islamic communities in Germany, that book, Germany Destroys Itself, and all of the discussion going on there. Lots of people have commented on the difference between, a perceived difference between how Islamic communities, Muslim communities live in the United States and how they live in Germany. I'm no expert on how they live in Germany. But when you look at it comparatively, do you see important differences? So if you think of these sort of three controversies together, the mosque, you know, the nonsense that took place in Florida, and now what is really a burgeoning debate in Germany, do you see differences and lessons to be learned?
Yes, I think it's really important to come to get a sense of what is happening in Western societies. Because in fact, for years, it was quite clear for me that what we are witnessing now in Europe is something which has to do with, you know, trends that are very populist, that they are using Islam as a threat. And we have now, you know, a shifting towards the right and sometimes the far right, you know, rhetoric. That things that were said yesterday by the far-right parties now are said in the mainstream. It's Islam is a problem, racist positionings, and xenophobia. So in my country, we banned the construction of the minarets, while in the country there are only four minarets. The headscarf in France, the schools and the mosques in Germany, mm-hmm. and the what is also coming from the States is all this literature saying, oh, Europe is turning towards Arabia. So the Muslims and the Arabs are everywhere. And I thought for in fact years, and you know, I have been following my connection to the United States of America started almost 30 years ago. And my first connection, in fact, was not with the immigrant Muslim community. It was with the African American, from what was happening in the struggle for the civil rights and the struggle for being able to say, don't talk to me about integration. I'm as much integrated as you, and maybe I was here before you, talking to the white people and saying, this is my country. But the problem is not this. It's not my country or not my country to be into. It's a question of social justice. And this is why it was quite interesting to see, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. saying, if we are wrong in our claim that we are equal citizens, it means that the Constitution is wrong. Mm-hmm. Using the common narrative to speak about social justice in this country. And this is what I got from the African American. They were able to start thinking about this. The immigrants come with another perception of how they have to deal with the society. And the immigrants in the States are not the same as the immigrants in Europe. They are much more educated. They were coming with very good positions, social status in the States, which is completely different from Europe. And what I thought for years is that what we had in Europe is not going to come to the States. This kind of Islamophobia and this rhetoric about Islam and Islamization. And to tell you the truth, it's quite disappointing. What we heard during the last 3 months in this country, revealed by this controversy around the Park 51 and the community center in New York, and then burning a Quran day, which is revealing that deep down in the American society, there is fear, mistrust, and we heard the same words that we had in Europe. Stop Islamization of America, which is completely different. The numbers, the figures are complete. It's completely too. But the fear and the mistrust, and always the same. When elections are coming, we have the process of this starting. People want to win the next election, and they are going to instrumentalize anything which can help them to spread around fear and to get to attract voters. This is exactly what is happening in this country. We had it everywhere in Europe and all the countries that I was mentioning, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Germany, France, Britain, even just after July 7th, in 2005. So I would say here that we have something which is coming, which is really worrying about the reality of what is happening in this country. And my position on this is we have to start with a framework. And the framework is we have to be true to our principles. There is a constitution in this country. Freedom of religion means something in this country, and there are rights to be respected. As I talk to you here, 30 mosques in this country are prevented from being built because people are pushing and saying, what do they want? What do they stand for? This is plain discrimination. We should not accept that. Not because it's a Muslim business, it's an American business. It's the future of our pluralistic society. We should not put ourselves in the margin. Let us be in the mainstream. And this is why I was very happy to see Jewish intellectuals, leaders, politicians, Christians, atheists, and scholars and coming and say, this position on the Park 51 was wrong. It's wrong according to the rights. Mm-hmm. And why I'm asking the Muslims and the American Muslims to understand the whole picture, they should understand that while you resist instrumentalization of fear, because this is very dangerous, any populist trend is dangerous for democracy. Mm-hmm. They use the democratic system to drive the people towards something which is emotional politics. And with fear, racism and implosion within could happen. Mm-hmm. So we have to resist that. But at the same time, in the name of our rights, we also have to respect the fear of the people. So when you are an ordinary American citizen, it's quite normal to be scared about the Muslim presence with all what we hear about Islam today in our TV sets, in our living room. So respecting the fear, resisting its instrumentalization. It means how do we deal with our fellow citizens? How do we deal in the society? And this is why I would go for rights, but also to get a sense of the collective sensitivity, the collective psychology, and to reach out to people, to make them understand our religion is not exclusively about our rights. So I would like, for example, American Muslims to be much more open to this collective sensitivity, to reach out, and also not only to speak about Islam. Mm. You know, when you belong to a country, you care about education. You care about social justice. You care about the environment. You care about everything. This is your country. This is your people. And not you only come, oh, we have a problem with Islam, come to us and rely and create alliances for that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we are too much on the defensive and not enough assertive on our belonging to the country.
Before I open it up to questions, I just want to take kind of interlocutor's privilege and ask one question coming out of my own work on you and writing about you. And that's to give you a chance to respond to what was probably the foremost attack on you in recent times, which is a book by Paul Berman called The Flight of the Intellectuals. I'm sure you've been asked about it and you know about it. And, you know, I thought that a lot of the book seemed guilt by association. In other words, you are the grandson of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. If you look at the whole tradition of the Muslim Brotherhood, there are bad things there, there are good things there. Paul seemed to pull together all the bad things. But he made one claim which I, in my own article on you, thought that you should reply to. In other words, if there are bad things there in the tradition, in your family tradition too, and good things, is it, in your view, incumbent on you to reject the bad things, to say, I disagree with my grandfather's view on this and that? Or is it a kind of imposition? In other words, and I suggested this in my article too, that you're not responsible for everything your grandfather said or your father or anybody else you've ever dealt with. You write what you write. That's what you believe. But it was a very sharp attack on you. It caused a lot of controversy here. What was your feeling about that book? And do you feel some kind of obligation to endlessly repudiate views that your grandfather may have had?
It's a good question, I think. I'm just having three, there are three steps in my reaction to this. The first is, for example, with the book of Paul Berman, and I was surprised by the level, to tell you the truth. I was told that he's a great, you know, intellectual, and then I found in the book that the 80% of what he's saying is translation of what he said in France, in French. Mm-hmm. The same arguments, it's as if it's new in the U.S., it's not. So I responded to many of the things in France. I'm not going to start again to be on the defensive. And it's a game. You know, people, you know, I know who I bother and why I bother them. So I'm not going to, I know also why there are these attacks. Sometimes it's just, I call them strategic distraction. You have a vision and they push you to respond all the time and you end up just doing this all the time. And not on you, because they have nothing on you. And the only thing that you can do when you have nothing against someone, you say, oh, double talk. So if you say to someone, double talk, so whenever I say something, I don't mean it. Mm-hmm. So there is no discussion. But it's not new. Anyone who studied history of Europe knows that with the Jews, we did exactly the same in the 20s and the 30s. Double talk. Double loyalty, international connections. This is what he said today about Muslims. International connections, they are coming everywhere. So it's not new for me. I got the point, but I'm not going to waste my time. So this is one attitude. The second is then to come to some of the points when it comes to my family. And I studied all what my grandfather wrote and he thought. I even wrote a book about this. And then what I'm asking the people, 95% of what he wrote is not translated in European languages or in English. It's all in Arabic. Mm-hmm. So, one, I want the facts to be right. So I'm not going to accept, because it's my grandfather and it's the Muslim Brotherhood, to respond to allegations that are wrong. For example, because my grandfather accepted and welcomed the Mufti of Jerusalem mm-hmm. at that time, it means that as the Mufti of Jerusalem thought against the British and the French, that he should be with the German at that time, with the Nazi, that he was himself a Nazi, or my grandfather welcoming him is a Nazi by association. Mm-hmm. I say, what's this? Is this historical understanding? While we also had people from the Stern group in Israel trying to be in touch with the Third Reich in order to be against the British. So we contextualize for some and not for others. Mm-hmm. That's not science. This is not history. But more importantly, I responded to Berman by saying, have you read what my grandfather said about the Nazi and the fascist organization? Because you are taking, he protected the Mufti, and then you elaborate on that by saying he was himself pro-Nazi. He said exactly the opposite. And I quoted that by saying, look, come to the facts, saying that nationalism going towards fascism and Nazi, this is the distortion that is a disease in the West. He's not advocating this, so come with the facts. But he doesn't read Arabic. So this is one. The second thing is the facts. Now, as to my position towards my grandfather and my father, I put every single human being in a historical context and try to understand what they tried to do. They were against British colonization. They had a perception of the West which was a powerful presence taking over, and they were resisting, and they came with the thought of the 40s. So with this, there are many things with which I agree. I would have been against colonization. But they are using means, understandings, that I may disagree with. Even, for example, the very concept of an Islamic state, if you read all what I'm saying, it's quite clear that I'm distinguishing myself from qualifying a state, while I am much more interested in the principles and not in the model, as I just said. So I am in a critical discussion with my own legacy. To have people coming to me and say, you know what your problem? I have the clue of your problem. It's your blood. I say, okay, I'm sorry. I don't think with my blood. And not more importantly, your blood is the problem, and you have to tell them it might be that you don't know even the blood of the origin that you are talking about. You are essentializing things. So I'm ready for a critical discussion, but I want it to be serious. I want it to be academic. I want it to be scholarly rooted. And I don't want all these rumors, you know, because you end up all your life saying, okay, you know what, this is a controversial, I'm dealing with this with the book, and say, he's a controversial scholar. I say, you know, let us be frank between you and me. If you speak about Islam today, Islam per se is a controversial topic. So that's it. I'm talking about the controversial topic, and what I'm trying to do is to open up. I'm criticized within the Muslim community. There are six countries, Muslim majority countries, where I cannot go. I'm criticized here in the West. I'm trying to bridge the divide and to work on both sides together with one word, one understanding, one vision. And at the end of the day, if the people are not able to trust, we are not going to be able to live together. Because the very beginning of our discussion here is that we may disagree intellectually, but there should be trust in what you are saying and what I'm saying. If I don't trust what you are saying, it's just not a dialogue. We are pretending to debate, but in fact, it's much more judgment than discussion.
Well, I want to thank you for fielding that question, because in I think you have been unfairly accused of dodging that question all the time, and I don't think you've dodged it here, and I don't think you've dodged it elsewhere. Let's open it up to questions from the audience. We got one right here.
Two questions. First, thank you for coming to the Free Library of Philadelphia and for your comments. What country or countries are you a citizen of? And then the second question is, my impression is that there is not a great voice within the Islamic community speaking out against violent suicide bombers. And I'm curious what your perception is as to whether that's an appropriate impression.
So the first question is, I'm a citizen of the great Switzerland. I'm a Swiss citizen. So I was born and raised in Geneva, and I did my study there. And then I went to Egypt for my Islamic sciences, and I was trained there. But originally I am from Egypt. So the way I put it, just to make it clear about my identity, if you want to know who I'm a Swiss by nationality, Muslim by religion, Egyptian by memory, European by culture, universalist by principle, Moroccan by adoption. But it's a very important point. It's when you come now to the state and your people are saying, you know, we are used to speak about hyphen identity. You can be an African-American, you can be an Italian-American, a Latinos-American. I think that we have to go deeper than that, because it might be that the hyphen identity is just also, you know, isolating the people. I don't think that we are succeeding in going beyond that by coming together and reaching out. It's much more words than realities on the ground. So this is why I think that we have to nurture the sense that we have multiple identities and that we have to reach out with others. The second thing is, I'm very often asked this question about the fact that the Muslims are not enough vocal in anything which is condemning terrorism and extremism. And I would say, look, the problem that we have is that when you organize, or someone organized, and I can give you an example, this was in the 90s in Britain, 8 people were organizing a conference on jihad and the call to launch a jihad against Britain and to work for having the Islamic flag on the 10 Downing Street. Well, 360 journalists coming, because it was a big story. When we have 25,000 Muslims coming and speaking about the fact that we are European, that we are citizens, one journalist. It's not news. Bad news are news. After September the 11th, and then what happened in Madrid, what happened in Britain, what happened in Casablanca and Amman, not less than 16 Islamic councils condemned terrorism and extremist violence. 16 around the world. It's as if it doesn't exist. The point is that we are in a vicious circle. One man with 50 people behind him, following him, is saying, I'm going to burn the Quran. The whole world is talking about that. And in the Muslim majority countries, what did they say? This is America. Well, when you are in America, we say that this man is not representing neither Christianity nor the American society. But the perceptions are coming with he is representing. We are. So it's the vicious circle is the way it's covered, but we cannot blame only the media. We also have to blame ourselves, because we get what we are waiting for. It's just, you know, simplistic news and perception of the reality. And then this is why I'm very often saying to my fellow citizens, the non-Muslims, listen to the other voices. They are talking. It might be not covered by the media, but we are talking. And you know, just the week after September 11, I was invited by Time magazine here. And I said, not only it's not Islamic, it's anti-Islamic, it's wrong. I was condemning it. For years, I have been asked, oh, we haven't heard you enough. I said, I'm sorry, till when am I going to repeat this? But it's also something which is problematic. Why? Because we are always on the defensive. You know, you are just responding to this. So I agree with you. We have to be vocal. We are vocal. We might be sometimes more critical towards some Muslim behaviors. I completely agree with this. But we also want from our fellow citizens to listen more to other voices. What is covered by the media is creating a perception of the reality. And as a citizen, you need to go beyond the perception to get a better sense of what is really happening in the Muslim majority countries. And I can tell you, the consensus, the great consensus among Muslims, is just to condemn that in a clear way.
Other questions? Is it one back there? Yeah. You. Mm-hmm.
It seems like every time a Muslim person comes to speak, that question of, well, how come you didn't speak out enough against the terrorist attacks comes up. And I guess my feeling about that is maybe people who are not Muslim are just not looking in the right places, because the mass media in this country doesn't give voice to Muslim people. And it just seems to me that you have to be willing to go outside. Non-Muslims such as myself, we have to be willing to go outside of our own little shells to see, because I have seen plenty of writing on the web, plenty of Muslim organizations on the web condemning terrorism, condemning September the 11th, and condemning these acts. It's just that it seems to me that most of us who are not Muslim are not willing to go beyond what our government tells us, what our white-owned mass media tells us. And so I guess what I'm saying here is more of a statement than a question, that I think instead of firing the same question over and over and over again at Professor Ramadan, that we ought to look in ourselves to see where, what kind of looking have we done? What kind of covers have we pulled back? And how far have we gone from what's fed to us by the government and by the media?
If I may just react, it's a statement, it's not a question. But, you know, to tell you the truth, why am I here and touring in the States? It's not only to present a book, and the book is really about us as citizens. My main concern is this one. We can be passive here and just complain and blame, you know, the Tea Party and the new xenophobia around us because there are people saying, oh, stop Islamization of America and nurturing this fear and mistrust. We can do that, and it's very easy to be passive and to blame the other. But there will be no future in the States. And this is why when I wrote the piece in the Washington Post just after what happened in New York, I said that the Muslims should not lose hope in what is happening in America. But this is where us, and I'm advocating in the book the new we, us, this is America. Look, all the colors, all the different backgrounds and religions. We really have to be serious about that. Which is really, if we are citizens, we understand that it's not only about rights, it's also about obligations. And the obligation is to go beyond perceptions and to try to reach out, to know your fellow citizens, and to be in this understanding that there will be no future in pluralistic society. We can't get a pluralistic society by being passive citizens. You need to go beyond the perceptions, to reach out, to try to understand, to know. We should be active. This is our answer to people who are instrumentalizing fears in our society. All the democracies and the United States as well as in Europe, we are in danger of emotional politics by people using ignorance and fear against each other. They will win the next election, but we have to blame ourselves, not to stand up and to be vocal by saying we are not going to accept that. We are knowledgeable citizens and we want to resist these trends. Because this is very dangerous. Very dangerous. When someone, you know, I have been born and raised in Switzerland and someone for 4 minutes looking at me and say, you know which mistake we did with you? We made a mistake with you. Is that we give you the citizenship. Meaning by this that I am less a Swiss because I'm too much a Muslim. And I'm happy to see non-Muslims coming with me, fellow citizens, being able to stand up and say, this is not the way forward. So I would say we have to be much more vocal. We should radically be vocal against the radical extremist voices, populist on one side and extremist on the other, but to come together and to listen to each other. So I would say that out of what you are saying, we can blame the media, blame the neocon, but at the end we will have what we deserve. Passive citizenship could just lead us towards bad governance.
Do you have a question right here in the front row?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for coming. I agree with the progressiveness, and I like the way you extracted the spirit of Islam, and that's the way I see it. I'm a convert to Islam, and of course I'm born and raised here, and this is the reason I'm here is to learn from you. And my question is, when I heard you say traditional Islam and mainstream Islam and then progressive Islam and then we, my question is, does this progression come out of traditional Islam? Does it come out of the Mithahab? And is there a new form of ijtihad that has to be done, that has to, like, for years the doors of ijtihad were closed, and I understand that wasn't true. Also, the historical context that you say that your grandfather went through, now we're in a new historical context. So where does this come out of? Does this come out of the scholarly world, this progressive Islam, or who is this we? And I guess that's my question. That's okay. A lot of questions.
Two things. Just I want to distinguish between two things. When I was talking about the we, I was talking about we as American citizens or European citizens. This is the we where we have to come together as citizens, and this is what we have to do. And I'm advocating national movements of local initiatives. If we want to solve the problem, don't wait for the problem to be solved in Washington. In Philadelphia, we need to come together as citizens and working together, not against, but for the future of this country. And it's completely different. You come for something when we have the same values and the same vision, that we are speaking about equality, that we are advocating, you know, social justice, social equality in gender. This is where we have to come together. So this is what I call the new we as citizens. And we should start at the local level here in this city, in this place. And this is also an attitude which is important to stop the victim mentality. The great danger of our time is this universal disease of all feeling that we are victims. You know what Bush was saying just after September the 11th? We are the victims of these people. They want to attack us, so we are the victims. While on the other side, the people are saying we are the victims of America. So it's a world of victims. Where are the subject? Where are the people who are the subjects of their history standing up and saying, no, we are not victims? We are victims, yes, but we are not going to nurture the victim mentality. We have to stand up. We might be victims of social injustices and anything else, but we have to stand up and to be active. And I would say that this is where we need to find this new way. This is one thing. Now, for the other part of your question, quite quickly, what I'm saying is that if you look at all my books dealing with Islam and the Islamic tradition, you will always see that they are rooted in the tradition. You know, myself, I was trained in a very traditional way. It's a one-to-one. I was with the sheikh, one-to-one, in seven disciplines to get the ijazah. The ijazah is when the sheikh is giving you the authorization to teach, that you are reaching the level. This is a very traditional way. This is the way I was dealing with scholars. And I'm coming from this tradition. But my understanding that within this tradition, we have trends. There are people having a specific way of reading the sources or connecting to specific schools of thought, the madhab. And within this, we have evolution. So it's in the name of the roots that I think that we have to understand the evolution of thought. So I'm not trying to reform the text. The texts are not going to change, but to reform the Muslim minds, the way they read the text. The way they read the text. This is a very important thing. Not undermining the reality and the essence of the principles that are immutable. I really think, I spiritually really think, that it's very important to pray, and to pray five times a day. For me, it's not disputable. This is a principle which is to fast. We have a mufti in France saying that to show to your fellow citizen that you are open-minded to socialize, just take a cup of tea during the day, that this is not Islam, this is, you know, how it could be, to please the people. It's not going to work like this. And by the way, you don't please the people by saying this. The people respect you when you respect yourself. I say, these are my principles. And in America, it's very important. Because there is a religious sense, sentiment that is sealed there in America, which is very important. So let the people understand who you are, in which way you respect yourself. But the problem is that the people are on the defensive. Many Muslims are scared of losing their identity. So they stick to some principles, to some attitudes, and they don't question this. So I'm even going beyond the only concept of ijtihad in the book Radical Reform. I don't have time to come to this, but I think that it's quite important. Let me give you one example very quickly about something which is showing how the problem is also psychological. Some people left the Middle East and they came to the States. And in fact, for them, to be a good Muslim was to be a Muslim as we were in the Middle East, in Egypt or in Lebanon or whatever. And they come and they stick to these principles. And in fact, they don't move. They are still in this. And sometimes they go back home and they see that the Muslims in Egypt are progressing more than them living in the States. Because in fact, this is the psychological factor. When you are on the defensive, you stick to principles and don't move. If I move, I'm lost. While they are moving there. So some women living in the States get less rights in the Muslim communities here than they have in Muslim majority countries, because they move there and we don't here. It's of the psychological factor. The lack of confidence is pushing you to be strict on rules that you don't question. And this is a problem.
I was signaled that we only have time for one more question. How about you here in the third row? Yeah.
I'm sorry, too long answer.
But you're going to be signing books afterwards, right? Have a chance to talk to
people. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. We'll do that.
I'm a survivor of domestic violence, and I know you talked about extracting and modifying certain things in the Quran, and I was just wondering how you felt or how you read the surah dealing with the women, stating that the men are the maintainers and, you know, as a last resort to strike your wife.
Yes, this is an important question, not easy because you are dealing with many dimensions. Between the texts, the cultures, and the interpretations of the texts and the dressing, having a take on the text coming from the culture. This is why I tackle these issues on many texts. And Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, I have one chapter on women, and in the book Radical Reform, there is one other chapter on women, saying that we have two problems when it comes to women. The first one is reduction. Some scholars and some understanding is to take the text and to reduce the text to one verse. This is it. It's written. And with a very narrow interpretation. You know, الرِّجَالُ قَوَّمُونَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ. We have it in Arabic. The men have authority on women. That's it. And you come to this, while the text is not saying this, in fact. It's one interpretation. And the second problem that we have, so the first one is reduction. The second one is projection. Projection is to project onto the text your own culture. So all the cultures of origin for Muslims are patriarchal culture. Arab cultures or Asian cultures, and we project onto the text things that are coming from the culture, but they are not in the text. You read the text from the window of your culture, always. So sometimes you have to deconstruct this. In the name of the text, question the culture. So we have scholars explaining that it's Islamically right when you eat, for the men to eat first and for the woman to eat after. I say, where do we come from with this? This is completely cultural. No, it's Islamic. It's us. We always got it like this, yes. But it was in the name of a specific culture. So we have to come to a critical, you know, tension between the text and the cultural projection and to deconstruct this, which is not easy. Because not only the culture is influencing the scholar, but the scholar himself is rooted in a culture. Today I have people coming to me and say, the way you read the Quran is influenced by the way you are living in the West. Of course. Of course. That I'm taking this. So the point for me is not to betray the text, but to get a sense from the culture within which I live. So know a good understanding of the text and being able to take even from my culture things that are important. Having said that, reduction and projection, what we have to do here in this field is really to come to a deep understanding of what is in the text and to be critical about some of the interpretation. This is why I wrote a book on the messenger, which is an introduction to Islam by showing how, in fact, the messenger, the prophet, was with women around him, and in which way, for example, even in the mosque, the way the prophet was in his mosque is a way, you know, far sometimes ahead of what we have now in our mosques, where the woman cannot enter, they cannot even pray. We have some that the woman, it's just unbelievable how much there is a regression in our understanding. But it's coming from the two, you know, problems that I was mentioning. Now, on domestic violence, for example, they take one verse where there is a reference to beat your wife in one specific verse without taking what is before, what is the end, and all the verses that are dealing with this relationship between men and women. The last verse which was revealed about this relationship is to speak about what he put between men and women in the relationship. وَجَعْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مِنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا وَجَعْلَ بَيْنَكُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَرَحْمَةً. مَوَدَّةً is love, tenderness and love, and rahma is mercy. And you understand that in fact it's all what we need to get the relationship. A love is for your qualities and mercy is for your weaknesses. So you need this. You need to be full of mercy. No way of speaking about violence. And the final example for us is home. Is the messenger himself. he never beat a woman. So when you get all the verses in a chronological way, because we have 23 years of revelation, and you look at the final example, and for all the Muslims, the best examples is the messenger himself. He never beat a woman. You come to the conclusion that all what was said by some scholars, justifying such attitude in the name of culture, in the name of specific interpretation, for me is wrong. Domestic violence is anti-Islamic. It has nothing to do with our religion and with the whole message. We have to say it. And then saying this, in the United States of America, very often the people are listening to us and say, that's good that the Muslims are saying this for themselves. No, let us now come to the American narrative. It's unacceptable in any American family. Christian, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, atheist, agnostic, let us come together into something which is no to domestic violence. Because what we have now in the United States, as is in Europe, is not a Muslim business. Domestic violence is a universal disease. And you have, men treating women in a way which is not acceptable. So let the Muslims take the lead to be with others by saying this is not acceptable. And when it comes, for example, we launch a campaign in Europe against forced marriages, saying this is not Islamic, but not only it's not Islamic, but we have forced marriages with Christian, with tradition, in our societies today. This is not acceptable. So I would like not only to be on the defensive by saying it's not Islamic, but let us now be with our fellow citizens by understanding that we will solve the problem by being together in the name of the women's dignity by saying any man who is just trying to beat his wife or any woman is acting against our common human dignity, and we're not going to accept it. Let us be together in that struggle, and not just to speak, as Muslims we may have a problem. Yes, we have a problem as Muslims, and as I'm always saying, Islam has no problem with women, but Muslims may have. Thank you.
A fascinating hour. You have heard an hour of what Tariq Ramadan believes, what I believe, up for sale upstairs. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.